In this episode of Skeptico, Dr. Charles Tart explains why we need spiritual values born out of experience.
I think we need to have deep spiritual values, and they have to come out of experiences that really teach us at a deep level. They can't come from somebody preaching at us and telling us how we should feel and so forth. We need a spirituality in our culture that taps into what is real and taps in a deep way so it'll stand up to the stress of everyday life.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris. Before we get started with today's interview, I want to take a minute and thank you all for listening and for the support that you've given to me and the idea of Skeptico. That is, providing an open, in-depth dialogue about real science that doesn't fit into the conventional paradigm. We've had some great interviews already, and we have some great ones coming up. And we also have some exciting new developments that are really going to change the way that we do things around here. And I'm really excited to tell you about that in the next coming few weeks or so. In the meantime, we have a really great interview today with Dr. Charles Tart, someone who's been a real pioneer in the field of psychology, and in particular, looking at the way spiritual experiences impact and inform psychology. He's authored over a dozen books, 250 articles published in professional, prestigious scientific journals like Science and Nature. I spoke with him recently at his office in Northern California. The interview starts with him asking me a question about the interview.
Okay, so what's the focus of our interview today so I can focus appropriately?
I don't think you're going to have any problem. It's probably material you've covered a million times. But what I really wanted to get into was, you know, the paradigm shift, I think, is what I think this show, Skeptico, really needs to be about. And there's really two sides. There's one side in the whole field of consciousness studies and parapsychology that says, hey, the existing paradigm is what it is. We have a brain and that's it, and get over it. And there's this other side that looks at the world and says, how on earth can you come to that conclusion? There's all this data out there. There's all this natural history out there. How can we deny it all and keep moving towards this existing, the model that we have in place?
Okay, that's great with me. That stuff I think and talk about a great deal.
So if we could jump right into it, what I would find very interesting is for you to maybe go back a ways and talk about some of your background, some of your training. You know, you mentioned a minute ago, put on your geek hat, and I read in your bio that you actually started your education in EE at MIT, which I think very, very few people who start at EE and MIT ever change off of that course, because it's a pretty well-trotted course that leads to a lot of success. Why did you choose a different field, and maybe what did that whole background bring to you as you then ventured into psychology?
Okay, well, I got to go way back for this. Okay, when I was a kid, I was raised in a conventionally religious sort of way. And then as I began to grow up, became a teenager, I began to question it, right? And this is not just my story, of course. This is a lot of people's story. I began to think for myself. I became acquainted with science. I loved science. I couldn't get enough of it. I read everything I could get my hands on. And, of course, as teenagers are, I also became aware of the hypocrisy of adults who said they were very religious but certainly didn't act that way. So I became aware of the classic conflict between religion and science. Now, when I look back from a perspective of many decades, I find lots of people go through that conflict. And there's two common ways of solving it. One of them is to go to the one extreme of saying, right, science has shown that religion is all a lot of crap. I don't believe a word of it. That's superstition we can forget. The other extreme is to essentially get really attached to your particular religious beliefs and somehow try to not think about what science might have to say about those kinds of things. As a psychologist, I can say either one of those routes is unhealthy because it means suppressing part of reality and part of yourself. I was very lucky to discover a third route. I was a voracious reader as a teenager, and I found old books on parapsychology, on world religion and spirituality and the like. And I realized that my conflict wasn't uniquely mine, that back at the late 1800s, a lot of intelligent men and women went through that same kind of conflict. And they came up with a brilliant idea. And the idea was that science is not so much a particular set of findings as a method of actually seeing what's out there, getting actual data, and then trying to make sense out of it and so forth. But the data is always primary, not the particular theories that are popular at the moment. The data comes first. And they established psychical research, the forerunner of parapsychology, with the idea of let's apply scientific method to start sorting out what in the religion and spirituality field really is true and vital, and what is indeed just superstition and or psychopathology that ought to be gotten rid of. That's been my theme ever since, to try to build bridges there, because I think that spiritual part of us is an important part of us. I say that as a psychologist and from many other perspectives. You can't just stuff it away and ignore it. But on the other hand, you can't ignore scientific findings either, and so we've got to get the combined reality of these things and try to find a way so they can help each other. Now, this is the theme of my next book, incidentally, on how scientific findings in parapsychology actually provide a basis for taking certain aspects of spirituality seriously. You know, not that they prove the Baptists know more than the Buddhists or something like that, but that area can be taken seriously. You can be a spiritual seeker and a scientist and not sort of have to hang your head in shame as being intellectually inconsistent.
Can you go into that a little bit further? You just went over hundreds of years of history in terms of where scientific thought has gone. Maybe trace the path again. How did we wind up with the existing paradigm that does seem to dominate academia, if not our culture in large, a reductionistic, materialistic paradigm that has worked well for certain aspects of science, but really, if you look at other aspects of science, it's breaking down there too. How did we get to that paradigm? And let's just stop right there. What is the history of how we wound up with this paradigm?
Well, let's start with the fundamental fact behind the particular history, and that is that we're all idea junkies. It feels good to have a clever idea that seems to make sense of our world. And to remember that just because the idea feels good doesn't necessarily mean it's true, that's a hard discipline. Okay, now the actual history, okay? The West was dominated by the church, okay? You were supposed to believe what the church said was the authorities, and that was it. If you wanted to know something about the way the world worked, you looked in Aristotle or in church doctrine or something like that. Science was a rebellion based on the idea of, can't we actually go out and look at the world? If we want to see whether heavy bodies and light bodies fall faster or slower at the same rate, can we actually go drop some things and look at them instead of looking them up in the sacred text? We had to fight to bring that empirical approach in there. You know, the church as an establishment didn't want anybody doing anything to question what they did. And that led to a philosophy of materialism, and it was very successful in the physical sciences. There's no doubt about that. And of course, we love success, and the ideas that contribute to that success, again, we get excited about them. You know, fighting disease on the basis of a germ theory generally works one hell of a lot better than trying to exorcise demons from people. We like success. We like comprehensive ideas. But to me, the essence of science was to come up with a rule that if you put data primary, you go out and see what actually happened, then of course you're going to theorize about them. That's our human nature. We create ideas. But those ideas always have to come back to making predictions about stuff you can go out and observe. And if you go out and observe and things don't happen, it doesn't matter how wonderful your theory is, how intellectually cogent, how fashionable in terms of current other theories and so forth. If the theory doesn't predict what happens, it's got to go. So to bring it right down to the crux of the matter, total materialism, which is a philosophy that's identified with science, but really it's separate from science itself, it says basically spirituality is a lot of nonsense. You know, it's a bunch of hallucinations and illusions and delusions. But when you predict, then you can't see any phenomena that seem to transcend a materialistic understanding of things, it doesn't work. We can observe things that happen, that we can observe, that have effects in the real common shared world that show that a totally materialistic philosophy is simply inadequate.
What are some examples that would immediately pop to your mind that provide the best evidence that, first of all, your work is largely credited with being among the work that has founded the whole field of consciousness studies? Let's back up for a minute. How do we know there is a consciousness? It's interesting, fascinating to me as a layperson coming into this field and talk to someone like Dr. Sue Blackmore in the UK that's just written a book on consciousness studies, has interviewed 20 of some of the leading figures in consciousness studies, and the conclusion is, well, there really isn't a consciousness that's separate from the brain. Do we know there is a consciousness? Other than that we all know there is, how have we proven that there is a consciousness that's separate from the brain, the mechanics of the brain?
It really is hilarious, isn't it, that people can actually doubt consciousness. I'm reminded of when I was in graduate school back in the early 1960s, and I wanted to study dreams. And my professors kind of discouraged me from that because dreams weren't really very real, you know, and they were subjective. It wasn't like a real science. And in fact, I read a book by an English philosopher who proved conclusively there were no such things as dreams. I had nightmares about it all night long, was messing up my whole field of study. So, you know, the power of the human mind to talk itself into weird corners never ceases to amaze me. But let's focus on the critical thing you're asking. How can we talk about consciousness as being more than just the brain? I mean, of course the brain is involved, right? That's the personal computer that consciousness uses, and its characteristics affect what you can do. And the more we know about the brain, the better. But let me give you a specific example of where you can't equate consciousness with the brain, and that's a telepathy study. Okay, from a totally materialistic point of view, we understand what the brain does, and there's a slight electromagnetic radiation from it, which is incredibly weak. If you try to do a telepathy study, if you put people in a couple of buildings a mile apart or something like that, everything our materialistic conventional science says is that nothing will happen. The brain energy is far too weak for electromagnetism to carry a signal that well. Yet you get enough experiments working to show that sometimes people have telepathic contact. Well, they're using their minds, they're using their consciousness, and something observable is happening in the real world. You're getting a good score on a telepathy test. But no way can you reduce that to brain functioning. And yes, I know some people will say, what about quantum physics? And I say quantum physics is very exciting and leads to all sorts of expanded ways of thinking about reality, but there's nothing very specific about it yet that can explain something like telepathy either. So it's phenomena like telepathy or the healing effects of prayer or psychic healing, for instance, which again have actual effects in the world when we can't think of any conventional energetic explanation for it, that remind me that when we talk about mind and consciousness, we're talking about something that can do things that don't reduce down to strictly materialistic things. So let's study them on their own terms. Let's study minds as minds, consciousness as consciousness, instead of just kind of ruling it out ahead of time. You have to be real careful about ruling stuff out ahead of time. You know, I'm reminded by one of my favorite sayings by Henry Ford, who said, those who think they can and those who think they can't are both right. If you rule stuff out ahead of time, then by and large it won't work for you, which just increases your prejudice that things aren't going to work. It's understandable and it's human, but it's not very good science.
Sure. You know, you've mentioned there as proof of consciousness two things that are highly controversial within mainstream science, and that is telepathy and healing by prayer or intent. Are there any other areas that you would say lend proof to the idea that there is a consciousness, that there is an awareness outside of the brain? Any of your work in altered states of consciousness, does that point at all or lead you to believe that there is a consciousness?
Well, let me first comment on your using the word controversial in mainstream science. I wouldn't use the word controversial, because controversial implies two sides to a dispute, and each side is well-informed and arguing against each other. Okay? The average mainstream scientist knows nothing about the evidence for parapsychological effects or the independent existence of consciousness. And any opinion they have about that not being possible is simple prejudice. It's not controversy. It's not as if they've studied the data and found flaws with it. They're just prejudiced. It's simple like that. So the second part of your question, you know, can altered states of consciousness be involved in that? Yeah, I don't cite that as primary proof for the existence of mind as something more than just brain. But certainly the people who have experienced some altered states of consciousness, it's primary proof. I mean, as a typical example, a lot of people have had out-of-the-body experiences or near-death experiences where they find themselves functioning fully conscious, even sometimes feeling more conscious than ordinarily, but they're outside their physical bodies. Well, you know, a typical reaction that people have to something like that is to say, as a result of this experience, I no longer believe that any part of me is going to survive death. I know some part of me is going to survive death. I know directly what it's like to be functioning without my physical body. And, you know, from the outside, we can say, well, you weren't really dead, blah, 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 blah. But to them, that's direct kinds of evidence that carries a lot more weight than the opinions of outsiders.
I'd like to follow up on that part, if I could, because I think that is completely left out of the equation. You mentioned that maybe controversial isn't the best word to use, but there is this controversy, whether it's accurate to call it that way in the way that you defined it. But what's lacking in that, it seems to me, and I don't understand how it can be lacking, is the huge natural history that we have to suggest that these phenomena that we're trying to identify in a laboratory setting are real. Whether it's telepathy, I mean, I think just virtually anyone you talk to will tell you stories in their family of their old Aunt Gladys, who knew when her sister had passed away. And I mean, these stories are in every family. Or precognition of Uncle Harry, who has a dream and sees something happening and it happens. I mean, this is such an integral part of our natural history, across time, across cultures. How has this been managed to kind of be taken out of the equation as something that we can't even use as a starting point in our investigations? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think you're underestimating the power of the human mind to ignore information that doesn't agree with what it wants to believe. And I mean, scientists aren't unique about this. We do this in all fields of life. You know, we remember and we notice the things that make sense to us, and we tend to ignore the others. But of course, if you're trying to argue about the reality of something, it is ridiculous that the natural history of psychic phenomena and spiritual phenomena is just ignored as if it doesn't happen. I try to pay attention to it, you know. It's nice to bring things into the laboratory and simplify and clarify things and all that. But the art of doing relevant science is to constantly remember, what does this have to do with what actually goes on in the world?
Right. Which really brings to mind another quote of yours that has stuck in my mind ever since I've heard it, because it's really very deep stuff. And that's an interview I heard you give with Dean Radin, and you were talking about the practical applications of parapsychology. And you said it's the implication, not the application. And I think I'd like you to speak for a minute about the deeper implications of this awareness that our mind is, or our brain isn't the end of things, and there is a mind, and that there is a consciousness.
Well, let's think about it just in terms of how we're going to treat old people. Okay, as a way of bringing out the implications. If you think that the mind is nothing but the functioning of the brain, then obviously an old person is going to die soon, and that is the end of their consciousness. So suppose they have problems with their consciousness. They're kind of neurotic, they make a lot of suffering, they do unskillful things and all that. Is it worthwhile to try to help them? I mean, since they're going to die and that's the end anyway? But on the other hand, if various spiritual systems are correct, and we have evidence pointing in that general direction, that we somehow may survive death in some form, then maybe we've got to take a much longer-term view of how we deal with people. And we can apply that back in our own personal lives. You know, if I truly thought death was the absolute end, then I think the only sensible thing to do is to figure out how can I maximize my pleasure and what time is left, and certainly don't take any risks because, you know, this is all I've got and so forth. But if I look at the evidence and say I should take this spiritual stuff seriously, you know, not that it's necessarily absolutely correct the way it's expressed, but maybe I should take a long-term view, I'm going to live my life differently.
What do you think the prospects are for that kind of widespread paradigm shift to occur? How does it occur? Can it occur? What does the world look like after that shift does occur?
Well, that's a very difficult question because, you know, whether people change their beliefs and attitudes and so forth depends on so many things outside of reason. You know, I can talk about what evidence we have and the kind of things you can reason from that evidence. But when you're talking about mass consciousness sort of shifts, evidence probably has very little to do with it. I think we desperately need a shift to a more spiritual view. Because otherwise, you know, the whole game of life is pig in the trough. You know, how much can you get? You know, and so we're ruining the ecology and future generations will suffer. If death is the end, who cares? You know, I mean, we're going to be gone. We're not going to feel any pain and so forth. But if there is some more sort of spiritual continuity, for instance, you care more about what you're doing on a long-term scale for people that you don't have any apparently direct connection with and so forth. That is, to put it another way, I think we need to have deep spiritual values, and they have to come out of experiences that really teach us at a deep level. They can't come from somebody preaching at us and telling us how we should feel and so forth. We need a spirituality in our culture that taps into what is real and taps in a deep way so it'll stand up to the stress of everyday life. And given what I know about various spiritual experiences people have reported, that's going to bring about things like caring for the planet and other people and so forth. So where this really comes down to a bottom line for me is that I think of myself primarily as a transpersonal psychologist now. As transpersonal psychology is interested in those parts of us that go beyond our ordinary selves, that go into those spiritual realms. But the twofold job of transpersonal psychology, which is still a very young field, is to separate out the genuine from the false and then to find out how to make it effective. How can I teach you as a particular person methods to give you a real spiritual life that matters instead of a one-size-fits-all approach, or this is the way it says in the holy book you should do. I don't care whether you seem to fit into it or not. This is our real challenge, to come up with a spirituality that works at a deep experiential level for our culture and that is compatible with what we understand scientifically. Not scientistically, not forcing everything into a reductionist materialist framework, but what we know scientifically as a result of actual empirical test.
Okay, but I guess that's what I'm driving at. Can you successfully go off in this different direction as other people are going off in different directions and kind of saying, well, you know, we're going to kind of do an end run here and deal with people where they're at, hit them with what they're really experiencing, give them a transcendent experience, all of which is great and wonderful and very meaningful, I think, to people on an individual basis. But we still have this dominant paradigm that I think overshadows our not only our scientific community, but our culture in a lot of ways. It makes the box within which spirituality can fit very, very narrow. Don't we have to overturn? Don't we have to have some solid data that leads to solid theories that fundamentally undermine that paradigm so it is overturned? And is that going to happen?
We've got lots of solid data already, but people don't pay attention to it. That's why I say it's not a matter of evidence. I mean, if anyone would actually read the evidence for various psychic phenomena that underlie spirituality, they've got several thousand studies to read, okay? That's a career to even read all that evidence. But people dismiss it. They don't read it. I mean, I agree with you. The materialistic paradigm has bad effects, okay? And I'll illustrate that in a moment. But simply producing some evidence on the scale we're able to do it now doesn't seem to have much of an effect because it's not rational. To illustrate the point that the materialistic paradigm hurts, I don't know how many communications I've had with people over my career, phone calls, people talking to me after lectures, mail and so forth, where they've had some kind of spiritual or psychic experience, and our materialistic culture gives them no way to interpret that experience except that they were crazy, that they were stupid, that they were totally deluded or something like that, which does not make for particularly good mental health. You know, I've had to function as if I were a clinical psychologist many times just by reassuring these people that, yeah, lots of people have these experiences. They have names. They do imply spiritual reality, but they don't mean that you're crazy. But the materialistic paradigm just makes people suppress these experiences or worry that they're crazy, and that's not contributing to people's happiness.
Or I guess it makes them run to the other side that you mentioned in your initial introduction, which is run to the first religion that comes along that says, reaffirms what they're experiencing and casts it in a different kind of mythology. And isn't that really another barrier in some ways? And you talked about maybe those two being able to come back and meet, but there is still that rejection of the mythology of organized religion and some of the problems that it's caused, which is, I think, scary to people to venture in that realm.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt that organized religion has caused an enormous amount of harm and craziness in people and so forth, as well as doing a lot of good. It's like all human activities. It's mixed. But when people have experiences that show them that they better pay attention to some kind of spiritual reality, if they don't buy into the "I'm crazy, maybe my doctor can give me a drug to make it go away" approach, they may indeed get into some kind of weird cultish sort of religion, which will have an appeal because it's probably at least partially true, even if it's mixed up with sort of craziness. It's kind of like the way college students reacted to government campaigns about the evils of drugs, when they could tell that they were being lied to in a wide variety of ways. And then they rejected all that source of information, even though there was some good and useful true information in among there. We've got to sort this stuff out.
Right. Can you tell us a little bit more? You mentioned briefly about the new book that you're working on. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Again, it's this problem I see of a lot of people who would like to develop their spiritual side. They know there's something important there, even if they're unclear on what it is, but they feel that science has disproven all that, so it makes it very hard for them to actually put any energy into it and go somewhere. So what I'm trying to go over is the basic evidence for well-established parapsychological phenomena, as well as some of the further out ones that might be true or might not be true, and show how this fits in with the spiritual picture of the universe. I'll give you one specific example. Almost all spiritual systems involve prayer. Well, what's prayer from a materialistic point of view? It's talking to yourself. And, you know, some humanistically inclined materialists might say, well, maybe it's good for you to talk to yourself in a deluded way. It makes you feel better that Big Daddy's going to take care of you or something like that. But really, it's basically delusory. Well, idea of prayer is essentially that telepathically you somehow communicate with some other kind of entity, a god or a saint or something like that, and materialism dismisses that as nonsense. But wait a minute, we have lots of good laboratory evidence as well as field evidence that sometimes one human can communicate telepathically with another human. Well, that doesn't prove there are any saints up there listening to prayers, but it certainly makes it much less unlikely that your prayer is telepathically going somewhere and maybe having some kind of effect. That's very interesting when you open up that possibility.
And what else does your book explore? You mentioned some of the more controversial aspects of parapsychology. What do you find those to be?
Oh, yeah. Well, for instance, I want to review the evidence that we survived death in some form. And that's a much more complicated question than the existence of telepathy. There's been nowhere near as much modern research on that sort of thing. So that's one of the kind of things where I'll put in the category of saying, the evidence shouldn't be ignored. It's good enough to get our attention. But like most parapsychologists, I would not say that it's proof that somehow we survived death. But don't ignore it. It's one of the big maybes that I call it, instead of the ones that are really well-established. The well-established things include things like telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, psychokinesis, and psychic healing. I often talk about those as the big five, because each of them has dozens to hundreds of experiments that establish their reality beyond any reasonable doubt. But these other things have not been investigated with anywhere near that frequency or the rigor that's been brought on those other things.
What do you think of the work of, for example, Gary Schwartz at Arizona, or Ian Stevenson, who just passed away, I think, in the last couple of weeks?
Yes, a few days ago, actually, Stevenson passed away. Gary Schwartz's work is very ingenious. He's beginning to learn something about assessing the validity of mediumistic communications. But here's the part that really makes me unhappy. Gary Schwartz is probably the most active investigator of mediumship in the world, and one of the half dozen or dozen investigators. Now, you know, I think the question of whether we survive death deserves an awful lot of effort put into it. The fact that we have one person doing a few studies at the University of Arizona, and he's one of a handful of people, that's crazy. We're not investigating the things that really matter in life.
It just boggles the mind that where's a couple billion dollars to answer that question? I don't get it. What about Ian Stevenson? There's still people following up on his work, more researchers using his methods. And I read those reports and I find them very, very compelling when you look at them on a whole.
Yeah, I mean, Stevenson's work and those of his colleagues, to me, has certainly made me think reincarnation is a possibility. There's enough evidence there that I've got to consider that seriously. Although, like Stevenson, I won't quite conclude it's true. You know, I'd like to see a lot more research. But, and here's the same thing as in the mediumship research, there's only a handful of people working on reincarnation, and their funding is unsure. And so, you know, we're lucky we have any evidence at all, given the prejudice against doing the research and the lack of support for it. I would not be at all surprised if the funding disappears within the next few years, now that Stevenson is dead. There's a long history in America of money left to universities to promote parapsychological and that kind of research, and within a few years it gets twisted into more conventional kinds of things, because the universities don't want to deal with unconventional material.
Well, it's been a very, very interesting chat. Is there anything else that you're currently working on that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, I'll say a little bit about the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, where I'm working part-time as a faculty member in my retirement, because this is one of the few places in the world that thinks in the course of getting a PhD or a master's degree, you should not only have your intellectual mind educated, you should have your emotions and your spiritual side and your social skills and the like educated, and your body intelligence educated. We have a unique kind of education, which I wish I'd been able to go through when I went through school. But I had a conventional training. I learned talk power. I learned ideas and words really well, but didn't do anything for my emotional and social self. So I'm very excited at this stage of my career to be involved in this kind of education. And again, this is also an example of, you know, it's on the margins. It's not government supported or anything like that. That puts a lot of crimps in what we can actually do. But we have to think about the whole person and how to educate, you know. We have emotions. Can our emotions become intelligent rather than just something that distorts our reasoning sometimes? We have intuitive skills based in our body. Can we learn to make that intelligent rather than just sort of ignoring our bodies while we talk away a mile a minute? These are exciting questions. I'm glad to be involved in them.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because switching over to a different realm, I mean, the realm of business that I'm more familiar with, those are two areas that are just extremely popular and very, very hot right now. One is intuition, and within there's so many Fortune 500 companies that are devoting large amounts of dollars in doing intuition training because they're finding that it pays off for their people. And
yeah.
The other is emotional intelligence. It's been known for many, many years that the highest correlation to success of an executive is their interpersonal and emotional skills and not their math skills or even their writing skills. So it's funny how sometimes science is takes a while to catch up with kind of the more practical applications of some of these ideas.
Yeah, one of the most interesting experiments I ever saw was done by a parapsychologist named Douglas Dean. He's been deceased for a number of years now. But he went around doing precognition tests. People would have to predict a series of numbers that some computer would generate in the future, so there was no rational way of figuring them out. And he worked a lot with different groups of executives. And his final analysis was that if he divided the executives into the really successful ones and the not-so-successful ones by his criteria of had they doubled their company's net worth within the last 5 years, the ones who doubled their company's net worth, they showed a lot more precognition than the ones who hadn't. Well, that makes sense in a way, you know, because in a business, up to a certain point, you make your decisions based on the facts. And then a lot of time, all the facts aren't there to really know what to do. The executive who has this little precognitive edge, who can get this information from the future, has a real advantage in a situation like that. Now, if only we could learn to train people consistently to develop that kind of ability, wouldn't that be something?
Do you think that's going to happen?
I think it could happen. Whether it will happen, again, there's so many irrational factors that it's hard to say. Part of my research over the years, for instance, was in trying to train people to have better telepathic ability. And I had some excellent initial success. You know, and then I just didn't have the facilities to follow up on that research. But I think we can train people. But we're going to have to deal with irrational factors of resisting this sort of stuff, too, in order to make any headway there.
Going back to your earlier quote of it's not the application, the implication. Could it be that the application of some of these technologies becomes the path for getting that greater understanding of the implication? In other words, remote viewing, when that's more well-established and more used and more functional, does that then cause this paradigm shift and the general overall implication of it to work its way into our culture?
Yeah, it can certainly work that way sometimes. For instance, just talking about remote viewing, I was a consultant on the government's remote viewing research for a number of years, and I saw excellent applications of remote viewing that were done for some of the intelligence agencies, okay? And I can't really talk about most of these because I had to keep signing these papers that talked about a $10,000 fine and 10 years in jail if I said much, except for the cheap one that was only $5,000 and 5 years in jail. But just from what's come out in the public literature, a lot of times the applied remote viewing helped intelligence agencies solve things that they wouldn't have solved otherwise. And they had all these theoretical objections to doing stuff like that, you know. But the bottom line was they got intelligence they couldn't get any other way, and it was useful. So, yeah, usefulness can make us shift our beliefs, whether we have the intellectual justification for them or not.
Very special thanks again to Dr. Charles Tart for joining us today. If you'd like to know more about his work, head on over to the Skeptico website, that's Skeptiko, where you'll find links in the show notes. And as always, please keep us in mind if you feel like writing a review on iTunes or your favorite blog or wherever else you might feel a need to tell folks about Skeptico. Well, that about does it for today. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.